Are there any questions for this? Great, I'm glad everything is loosened. Yeah, please. I like that preface. There's usually something big coming up.
Yeah, you said, of course, you know, 2,500 years have passed, so, you know, funny enough, the story moves along. It does. This is what human cultures do with their thinking. And some people are quite preoccupied with, and they do the same with all, you know, with Christianity, kind of go back to the real thing before it all went horrible. Like some people with artists, you know, their original work was so interesting, and then, of course, you know, with the drugs and it all went a bit messy. And the same with a thread, you know, a cultural thread or religion, whatever, but you go back to the beginning, because it all, that was the real stuff, and then the inheritance is something that's kind of contaminated and spoiled, but that's not how you presented it, that this natural evolution and, you know, diversification and all that is just a, you know, it's just kind of what happens. Cultures evolve, and thinking groups evolve as well.
I'm a bit suspicious of that urge to go back to the real stuff. There is a rhetoric there I have come to be suspicious of.
Not mentioning any names.
No. Usually there is already an agenda. The clamoring for the real stuff would... Well, in the case of the Buddha, we'd have to acknowledge, strictly speaking, as historian of Buddhist meditation practice, we don't quite know what the real stuff is. We have a body of texts. We know that there is a gap of at least 300 years between the death of the founder and the more or less coherent appearance of these texts. We know that these texts have all been edited. They have been translated. Even the Pali texts, you have to assume that they are translated. We know that the effort to collate and anthologize these texts has been going for generations. We know that this has been in the hand of not necessarily named members of that community. So who am I to say what is the real Buddhism? I could say, let me get the earliest possible Buddhism. But even that is changing. You know, 50 years ago, we thought we knew what the earliest type of Buddhism is. Now things are not looking so clear anymore, because we have found other manuscript traditions, we have found other texts. We know more, we know things are more complicated than we believed 50 years ago. So the real Buddhism smacks to me of the sort of Buddhism I would like to be real, or real according to my criteria, which obviously, if we are going to establish criteria, real Buddhism from presumably unreal forms of, or degenerate forms or diluted forms of Buddhism, then we would also, for honesty's sake, have to clarify what my criteria for Buddhism are.
Yeah.
There are two big movements. One of them is syncretism. Yeah. Syncretism, basically we pick things and we mix them together, disregarding the specific context where they come from. We put them together because they seem meaningful to us, or they seem convenient to us, or we believe there is a market for it. So that's one big movement. We take things as we find it without paying much respect to the context where these things come from and the relation these things we have picked up bore to the context where they hail from. And the other big movement is sort of fundamentalism. It's, you know, I have a teaching and the truth and the lineage and a particular initiation, and I want to protect this against you and your degenerate forms of trying to make sense of this. So I'm the custodian of truth, I'm the custodian of orthodoxy, I'm the custodian of something that is pristine, and everything later is just a danger to it, and it is my job to keep it pure. Yeah. So both of these movements I can see quite broadly happening today. I believe that every attempt, every attempt to dogmatize a party line betrays the message that this party line actually tries to protect. I believe the way to make use and to safeguard Buddhist teaching for the future is by making it useful now, making it useful here. In other words, I believe the power to keep things in business comes from translating it into the situation in which we are in now. I have found Buddhist teaching accessible to me because people in Asia through centuries have made the effort to translate Buddhism into their situation. That's what kept it alive. Not by trying to keep it pristine and pure, but by making use of it. Yeah. The thing has stayed alive and has come to me because it has been translated and made useful to many different people in Tibet and in Japan and in Thailand, for me particularly. And it is their insistence on making use of it where they were, under the conditions they lived. That is what has passed it on. I hope this is a kind of answer. So it's not by preserving it anxiously that preservation actually is kept going. It is by making use of it and translating it and putting it to practical use in our lives that is going to pass it on. That's my conviction.
I came to know. Could I ask if you feel 2,500 years ago, or even in other cultures in the East today, it's as Buddhist teaching is as counterintuitive in those cultures of yesteryear, or perhaps in the East today, as it feels quite often in the West in terms of self and in terms of tackling greed, hatred, delusion, etc.
Yeah, it was very counterintuitive and countercultural in India. As much, the more I know about the Indian context, it was a smack in the face of Vedic family values, for example. Yeah, founding celibate monastic communities. It was, you know, the Vedic notion of life was not just a notion of life of a personal religious faith. The Vedic tradition had very clear cosmological notion. This was applicable to everybody. So, in say a Vedic concept, you didn't really have a lot of individual self-actualization going on. The story was, are you a man or a woman? In which caste are you born? And what age are you in? Those were the factors that determined what appropriate dharma you were to undertake. If you were a Brahman, if you were young, then you were to undertake study and to live celibate life. And if you had finished your studies, you were to found a family. if the kids were up, you were to leave that family and live at the edge of the village and practice. And if you were a woman, then your dharma was to cook and to have more kids. And you were not studying. You know? And if you were an old woman, you were ruled by your sons rather than by your husband or your father, and so forth. Yeah. So the notion of individual self-actualization and autonomy as we know it in the West is completely alien to the Vedic tradition. And the Buddha and his folks, he was only an exponent of a movement of religious reform in his day, only one of several of exponents, was completely countercultural. This was not just that he didn't believe this, but he actually attacked the foundations of this cosmological system by walking out of that system. Because according to that system, this system was applicable to everybody, not just to the Brahmins. Also, if you were not a beneficiary of that system, say, if you were born in a low caste and you were not allowed to enter a temple or even to practice that religion, you were expected to uphold those beliefs, even though you were not privileged by them. So the whole wandering ascetic movement and the religious seeker movement that thought that happiness and awakening does not come from fulfilling one's duty, but that would come from actually understanding the nature of experience, that was a real radical thought. And the people of the established traditions would feel that to be a threat. Yeah. People walking out on family values meant that was the social contract. Men walking out on that, even worse, women walking out on that. Under the Buddha, you know, women started to walk out of this family construct, which completely subordinated them to a male patriarchal structure or to a society structure. Suddenly, they were capable of independent happiness. They were capable of a life that was not defined by family values or the cosmological notions of Brahminical teaching. Yeah. They could become spiritual seekers, wanderers, leaving society behind in a big way. And that was definitely frowned upon. You have plenty of incidents where Buddhist disciples were accused. The Buddha was accused of famous things he was always accused of. He was born of Brahma's feet. You know, the Brahmins were twice born, once as Brahmins and once by a mother. And the idea of the Mahapurusha, the big being which gave birth to the different castes, and the Brahmins were born from the mouth. And the lowest part was the feet. So the Buddhist shavelings, as they were called, sometimes were born from the Brahma's heels. So from the place Brahma put his foot in the dirt, yeah. So there, you know, there's plenty of evidence even within Buddhist texts that Buddhism wasn't the bee's knees in those days. You know, some people felt this was a great teaching, and other people were both threatened by it, criticized it. There was an ascetic movement which felt that Buddhists were really indulgent; they were living in comfort because the. Well, nowadays, Buddhist monastic life seems quite sort of ascetic, you know, eating little, no TV, no sex, no money, seems quite sort of on the ascetic side of things. In the days of the Buddha, this wasn't the case. You know, this seemed to be quite cushy compared to some of the ascetic stuff that was going on. So Buddhists were accused of taking meals from rich people and wearing cloth on their bodies, woven cloth, which was precious. There's criticism that they were spoiled, that they wouldn't produce offspring. That was one of the criticisms then. The Buddha was accused of being a widow maker. Yeah. The ascetic tradition suggested that he would he would be indulgent because he didn't stipulate fasting and painful ascetic mortifications. Any serious self-respecting spiritual seeker needed to go into for some mortification exercises. And the Buddhists didn't. They were kind of meditating and they were kind of nice, but they weren't actually going around flagellating themselves, you know. They were encouraged to live modestly and have fewness of needs and things like that. But they weren't going around holding up their arms till their muscles atrophied, or they weren't wearing matted hair, or they weren't just eating grains of rice with the decreasing moon less and less and less, things like that. So they were actually quite perceived to be cushy, which is quite weird, because nowadays it looks like this is at the other end. Can we close the windows again? Thank you.
So there's fog over here, so these things keep going on. Sorry, I see.
What's the problem now?
There's a fog here where someone's phone keeps going on.
Sorry, it's just it off.
It's no problem.
So, Mike, I think it was probably countercultural and anti-intuitive at any time. Since the message that the stuff that we do to be happy is a motor in our societies, isn't it? It's a motor in our prosperity, sensuality, investment, the creation of safety, getting good at manipulating the world in ways that I get what I want, have always been sought as particular skills. And I think such a message is challenging to any society. A Chinese society, for example, is hugely materialistic. For many years I thought that materialism was the product of Judeo-Christian background, and when I went to live as a monk in Thailand, it became obvious to me that this is not the case. There is a non-Judeo-Christian materialism. Any exposure to Confucian societies will tell you there are some fairly convincing mercantile forms of materialism of another provenance than Judeo-Christian. And if you speak to Malay and Chinese parents when their sons want to become Buddhist monks, I tell you, they have some very similar feelings as, you know, my mom and dad will have had when I wanted to become one. It's not particular to our time. I do not think that the Buddha has been easy to... The Buddhist path has been easy to swallow and adopt by many societies. I hope this is an answer. Yeah, please.
I would like to thank you for making one thing clear, that I couldn't ever equate this compassionate figure of the Buddha with some of the books I read, which obviously I interpreted as trying to destroy my identity. And I felt because I misunderstood it. And I couldn't find a way how to understand it. And I found that so disturbing that I couldn't look at it anymore. And obviously I had the wrong idea about that.
Well, you obviously have the sanity to find that disturbing and distance yourself. Anything that tries to destroy your identity, I think, has to be handled with great care.
And it's not self. It's not self. Can lead to complete misunderstanding.
Well, you know, there's many forms of bad Buddhism out there. The sort of self the Buddha was teaching, that it was fictitious, is not something that has to be destroyed.
Yeah.
Fictitious things don't need to be destroyed.
Right.
They have to be shed light on.
Yeah.
And if they are not real, they will reveal themselves to be not real. If you turn on the light, you know, the light doesn't go out and destroy darkness. It just takes it away, isn't it? It sheds light, and then the darkness is dispelled. The idea is that this is what's happening when you understand the dynamic and process nature of the human body and mind. But there, the idea that you actually have to go out there and attack yourself and rid yourself of the thing will at best leave you with what my friend John Peacock calls a self-shaped hole, which doesn't solve the problem.
That's H-O-L-E. The whole, H-O-L-E.
H.
Must be confused with W.
No, H. Yes, please.
I just have a question about renunciation. About renunciation.
Renunciation.
And that kind of not being part of a psychological model necessarily, but being part, very much part of Buddhism. Kind of.
Well, I think even psychologists would agree that your capacity to postpone gratification is a sign of maturity, which you could put a renunciate spin on, you know. You get 2 marshmallows if you don't eat this one until mommy comes back. You know, this is a renunciation called for it, right then and there. You know. No, I've read about the marshmallow experiment, and I've seen the rehash of the marshmallow experiment 20 years later. You know, in Buddhist terms, you would call that renunciation. You would renounce immediate gratification, and you would do that under certain circumstances, with the promise of being freed from desire, or with the promise of a heavenly rebirth, or with the promise of getting more marshmallows later on. Yeah. Buddhists have done all kinds of tricks on this one. But the capacity to hold back on immediate impulse gratification, even psychologists would tell you, is generally a sign of promise. And you will find that you know, there's some famous longitudinal studies with people who have shown early aptitude at actually impulse control on immediate gratification impulses, and I found to be quite over average content and successful and well off and healthy on the basis of their early on capacity to do that, to be able to say, I'm not having this right now, which in Buddhist speak would be a form of renunciation. It would be a samvara, a restraint. Just, yeah. Is this an answer?
Yeah. I mean, do you think, because kind of my current thinking is that, you know, is it really possible to fully explore a kind of Buddhist practice without, you know, fairly full renunciation in all senses of.
What would you like to renounce?
Well, I mean, if you live a monastic life, then you renounce, you know, you renounce externally, and you also then renounce internal things. But, you know, actually, is it possible even just to pursue that if you don't have that external renunciation? And that's not something that psychology would necessarily, you know, I wouldn't imagine that hearing a psychologist or a therapist saying that somebody needs to kind of, you know, renounce externally
in order to progress down a particular path of awakening, psychology. Let me change hats on this question, yeah? So, as somebody who has lived the monastic life for 20 years with celibacy in the whole spiel, I sense great value in that. And the fact that psychology is not, or many psychological models don't seem to give an immense amount of importance to this. On the basis of personal experience, does not deter me from attributing considerable value to the strength that comes from giving things up. But renunciation needs to be specified. You can't give up without developmental preconditions. A, you can only give up what you actually can enjoy. Other than that, if you start trying to give up things that you can't actually have, don't have, or can't enjoy, or are afraid to have, then this is not renunciation, it's called fear. Yeah? And avoidance. And it is not a virtue. And it does not give you freedom. It just gives you some false sense of safety, and you pay some developmental prices for this.
Yeah.
So renunciation has to be specified. What are we renouncing, and who are we talking of? If I'm renouncing something I'm afraid of, then this is not renunciation. If I'm renouncing something I've never had, this is not renunciation either. This is fantasy. Yeah. So I do not think there is something like renunciation that is an a priori quality or virtue. I have to see who is renouncing what, when. Then renunciation becomes a possible virtue. Many of us would like to renounce tax paying, or would we like to renounce, you know, the turmoil and the chaos of relational life. Yeah. But I don't actually think you can do that, even if you live a renunciate monastic life. You know, your life will be full of relationship because you live with people you would never have chosen to live your life with. You depend on them. On so many levels. You may not have sex and kids with them, but you know, there's other ways of being close that they will get on your nerves, and they will have you in tears, and they will make your eyes water, and you know, they do all kinds of things with you if you live with them. And I don't see that you can avoid this. Even if you choose to live in a cave, and you have to have somebody to bring you your nettle soup, and somebody to do your visa, and somebody to, you know, give you a meditation instruction, somebody to bring you back to sanity if you've gone a bit funny after being 6 months on your own or so. You will need people. There's no way you can learn without relationship. At the same time, I think renunciation is a great value. It's good to find out what's happening if you don't sleep, if you don't eat, if you don't have sex, if you do things that you would not do when you were just seeking your comfort zone. This is very revealing. This is a very powerful practice. Maybe not for the rest of your life, you know, not forever, but it's very, very good to be able to renounce things. Much freedom comes from being able to give up things. Much bondage comes from our addictions to comfort, to safety, to, you know, you name it. You know, look at us. You know, the French philosopher Cioran said, you know, if you want to look at the misery of our lives, just look at the size of our pharmacies. I do think, you know, renunciation as a virtue is completely anti-intuitive and countercultural. It's really bad press. It really goes against the idea I can get what I want and I am powerful insofar as I'm capable of getting what I want. Renunciation is a real powerful message. Yeah. At the same time, I'm conscious that most people want to renounce the things they most urgently need learning to practice with. Yeah. If you give me the choice, I want to renounce the things I feel lousy at, I feel overwhelmed by, I feel afraid of. By. Yeah. So, and it's the job of, you know, a living tradition with real living human beings who know you and see you, to stop you from doing exactly that, and to point you to things you should renounce, which you may feel you want to have more of. Yeah. Does that make sense? The developmental bit in the living tradition is in the hands of real men and real women, yeah, who meet other real men and women who try to practice this. You can't get this from books. So if you read the books, it says, you know, practice alone, there are these empty places, seek out these trees, don't waste time, don't hang around chatting with your friends. Yeah, that's what it says. And meditate. But then you turn the page again and it says, you know, and in the evening when the monks were finished with meditation, they gathered together and talked through the night about their experiences. So you get various messages there. One is seek solitude, but not forever. Seek solitude and then meet your peers and actually try to contextualize your experience. There's a very active involvement. The Buddha was very, very active on community. He established facilitation programs, he established group processes, he established what do you call this in English? Yeah. The settlement of quarrels. You know, he was really... Yeah, conflict resolution, thank you. He was really on many, many scores, taking community, communal harmony and unanimity and interpersonal dynamics quite serious. If you look at, say, particularly if you look at his monastic discipline, that's where all this stuff is meticulously laid out. And this is obviously the chunk of text that is the least known in the West, but it's quite heartening to see how much time and effort and emphasis he put on relational aspects. And then yet the iconographic depiction of the Buddha is always this man with, you know, internalized gaze, aloof of the world, serenely smiling into this very world, but completely unattached. But if you look at the man, how the man lived, it's quite amazing. You know, 45 years of effort to get this thing off the ground. Yeah, please.
Yes, I would like to understand more the relationship between meditation and investigation. For example, this morning we meditated, we focused on that. In the afternoon, instead, we investigated our experience with the Satipatthana exercise. And I would like to see how one is supporting the other.
Well, there's many different ways of meditating. Okay, I told you the idea that we could call many, many different practices with one funny word in the West called meditation. It doesn't do justice to the breadth of meditative exercises. You see, you can meditate in many, many different ways, and the result will be slightly different. That hinges on what you want to do, and it hinges what you bring to this practice. So there is not one trick or one method or one approach. Generally, most of us need to train a variety of skills. Some of these skills are attentional, some of these skills are stabilizing, some of these skills are extending the capacity for temporal continuity in our attention. Yeah. Staying present longer than we habitually would. Some of these skills have to do with widening the space of our attention. Before we were maybe that small, and now we become that big. Yeah. So all of these things sound completely contrary, and yet they form part of one program of meditative training, which has many, many different facets. Some things you need to put at the beginning, otherwise the rest is not very likely to happen. So one of the things we need to put at the beginning is being connected to the body. Another thing we need to put at the beginning is learning to make the mind more still than it is. If it's very still, to make it even more still. If it's crazy, to make it a little less crazy. Doesn't matter, but you need to be able to have the skill from where you are to bring it to greater calm. Now, I would rate that skill to be very primary. And then at some point, you need to be able to look at what stops the mind from getting still. Yeah. You try to make the mind still, and you made it a little more still, and then there are things which stop it from getting even more still. And you will need to have a look, a close look at what that is. Because just trying harder to make it still will not help you make it more still. You will actually need to inquire very specifically what it is that makes your mind not still, or what it is that obstructs greater stillness. Depending on what it is, you will then choose other tools. Does that make sense? Yeah? It's more than a weekend's program. Yeah, please.
Earlier on you were saying that we might be lacking something in comparison to somebody who is born into a society or in a culture where it's culturally, or Buddhism, or it's a cultural religion since centuries. But I thought, couldn't it also be a positive thing, because that way we are more forced or even or more willing to inquire into it, rather than if with any religion at all, if it's the culture, we might just follow it and do the rituals, but without really thinking about it and living it. So it could just be, just go through the motion, but not really living.
I wasn't thinking that these people I referred to, I think I mentioned Northeast Thailand, are necessarily very privileged. You know, they will have just different conditions. We bring things along, they don't bring along. There is no doubt in my mind. It's just we need to find out what our condition needs. Yeah. It will be different than their condition. Every society has a different facets. We are pretty good at being autonomous, being resilient against peer group pressure, being able to do things on our own. You know, in Thailand, the most difficult thing monastic life seems to be perceived as is to be on your own. You don't have friends. In Thailand, you bring somebody to the station just so that he is not alone. You know, it's considered impolite to let somebody walk alone. Even if you don't like the guy, you're accompanying him because it's felt to be your duty so that he is not alone. Which is slightly different from what you have grown up. Yeah? This translates then if you have a bunch of Thai ladies who go into a retreat center and there is individual rooms and group rooms, all the Thai ladies go into the group room because they don't want to be alone. And if you do the same experiment with Western women, you know, everybody goes into the individual room because they don't want to be in the same place. And men the same, by the way. So, you know, we have different conditioning. Now, some of that conditioning is useful and helpful, and some of that conditioning needs counteracting by practice. I don't think we're doing so bad. We're just doing bad on a few counts. We're really good at hating ourselves. our culture seems to really bring about an immense enthusiasm for self-hatred and the misery that comes out of this. Many Asian teachers are surprised to what degree Western people are willing to engage in aversion against themselves. And they're quite helpless and baffled by this. How much self-compassion we need to even be able to handle ourselves. Not even meditate, just be with yourself and think. I was teaching in the States last summer, and the Boston Globe just published an article about a famous study, actually three studies about mind wandering was one of them, and the other one was the practitioners who people who were just taken off the road and given the task to sit in a chair and think for 15 minutes. Nothing in particular. Not even meditate. Just sit in a chair, not play with their mobiles, not read anything, not do exercises. Or so. Just sit in a chair, and they were allowed to think what they wanted. And then there was a device that was capable of administering electric shocks. Unpleasant, non-dangerous electric shocks. They were given a test to see how this felt. It was, and then they were asked whether they would pay some money so that they weren't given these electric shocks. And two-thirds said they would give money, at least $5. They were given a fictional amount of money, and they said they would invest all their money so that they weren't administered electric shocks. And then they were left to their devices to just think there, not do anything. And the toy was left with them. And two-thirds of the men and one-third of the women chose to administer electric shocks to themselves in less than 15 minutes of being on their own. One guy, 190 times. So you have to see that just to be able to be with ourselves and think whatever we like is obviously by two-thirds of the male population still felt to be so unpleasant that it is preferable to spice things up with something that you know is going to be unpleasant, but at least provide some stimulus. rather than just sit there and think, which I think is a real statement. It's quite a startling sort of statement. Yeah. I forgot what the sample was, but I think the end was at least 45 people or so. So it wasn't just three guys who, you know, were all from the same leather fraction. It was obviously the task of sitting in a chair with yourself and think something without having a toy to play with makes reaching out for a stimulus that you know is unpleasant, but still a stimulus, so tempting that over 60% of men resort to this and do something that is known to be painful. And yet, it produces some form of action. So we don't seem to be so good at just being with ourselves and thinking our stuff. Yeah.
No, just it made me think of a quote by Pascal de Purbis, known by lots of people, that says that most of the evils of our society are due to the fact that a person can't sit alone in a room without doing anything. And also I thought of sort of sometimes in teachings there is an expression which is used, and I think that's highly misunderstandable, and it actually collides and colludes with the Western sort of particular attitude to self-hatred, and it's called self-cherishing. So it's sometimes in Buddhist teaching, self-cherishing is the way in which you are invited. You are invited not to self-cherish, basically. It's considered quite an egocentric. And I think the expression to start with is completely out of order for us, because we need to self-cherish, considering that there is lots of self-hatred.
Yeah.
And so maybe it should be put differently. The word should be different. The wording of it should be different. But it can be very misunderstandable, especially in sort of Buddhist cliques, whatever, and in which certain attitudes are sort of taken for an indulging rather than an attempt to learn to care. And also, yes, there is all that sort of confusion between the self in psychology and the self in Buddhism. I mean, if one would become actually oneself fully, there would be a great revolution. It would be a great inner revolution. Maybe once one has become oneself, it's my opinion, it's quite opinionated, you can sort of let that go. I mean, so, you know, once you have this healthy psychological sort of thing into action, then you can sort of create a big space and
there's quite a few things in there, isn't
there? Yes, there is something else is coming, because and it's something else is that actually I found myself in this sort of thing between Buddhism and therapy. You know, I'm sort of great lover of everything that can help liberate, so whatever it comes from. But at first I was more involved with therapy, and then I realized, I mean, when I first met Buddhism, which was many years ago, I discovered for the first time the beauty of completely opening up the perspective. You know, that I didn't need to be stuck in any sort of relative biographical story. There was something really big that could go on for each of us there. And so that gave me an incredible amount of steam for quite some time, until I sort of I bumped into parts which needed to be looked at. And that was just with a simple, basic sentence of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I went to, I had been dedicating myself mostly to meditation by that point and to Buddhism. Then I went to one of his, and then I sort of was encountering things which are still dragging me back, you know, that are still sort of an obstacle, quite a big obstacle. And so I went to his one of his lectures, and he said something very simple that we all know, like, I've noticed that the people who tend to be more optimistic in life are those ones who had quite a good childhood, which is basic, OK? guys. And so I thought, oh well, maybe it's time that I go and look with other, with the tools that my culture has got so available. And
my luck, this may have been just right. You know, maybe you needed to dedicate yourself for a while and
yes,
come back to the biographical work with
yes,
after having some more Buddhist practice under your belt.
Yes, yeah? I like the and because a lot of time I get obstacled by the idea that I've got to do out and no.
There is good reason that, you know, we play our cards right. We have certain advantages from our background, our culture, we know certain things, and there's no reason, just because they don't have Buddhist names, that we should not make use of this. It's difficult enough to wake up. If we have tools, if we have models and understandings that are helpful, that prove valuable, then I see no reason why we should renounce them if they are genuinely helpful. Many things can be found in psychology, for example, that you would look in vain for in Buddhism. Great conceptual clarity about things that trouble us. Defense mechanism. You will be looking in vain for a clear description of defense mechanism in Buddhist teaching.
Yes.
Yeah. It's useful to know something about your defenses. It's useful to know something about how they work. It's useful how to recognize them, maybe first in others and then finally in yourself. Yeah. That is very useful, even if you're a meditation practitioner. I'm grateful for that clarity. I'm grateful for these conceptual tools. There is no reason I have to be snooty at such offerings coming from a corner which doesn't speak in Pali or in Tibetan, yeah, but speaks in the terms of Anna Freud or so. Buddhists can be learning a lot from this. Yeah. Just because they don't have Pali or Tibetan terms for it doesn't mean that they have no defense mechanisms. They very likely have some. And I find that the translation of contemplative practice into the actuality of our lives takes a lot of effort and more time. And anything that helps in that process, make us more clear and more free and more aware, is probably a good thing. Yeah? We don't need to be afraid that it's coming from the wrong corner. Yeah? So I'm glad you found what you found.
No, I love the fact that you talk of a dialogue. Sorry, because I found door closed in both sides, okay? And so I like the fact that you were talking, that curiosity, because not necessarily, now we are stopping at two lines. One is Buddhism and the other is psychology. I think there are many more that can brought in. The comic, ironical thing is that I sort of started something called attachment therapy, which if it goes, you know, attachment is in Buddhism something that has got a very different take on.
Yeah, so, very interesting theory. Good. Other voice, the last one. Please.
I'm talking about translation today and about the kind of the continuum of fundamentalism and
synchronism.
I wondered what your opinion is about the kind of the mindfulness explosion that has happened at the moment, mm-hmm. and how that fits into translation at the moment. I felt that possibly a little scepticism about some of the some of the ways that it's been treated at the moment, and yet I guess it could be interpreted as being very relevant as well to the world.
Well, it depends which corner you look at. I, for a long time I thought I won't have anything to do with this, and now I've joined them, basically, because I realized that it's a lot more subversive to join them than to just pretend not having to have anything to do with it. I think it's good. Mindfulness goes into places where I, as a Buddhist teacher, would never get into. And I'm grateful for that. I even think mindfulness practicing Marines are better Marines than non-mindfulness practicing Marines, to be honest, even if it is creating much outrage for some folks that this is the case. I have a great trust in the subversive nature of mindfulness. Under whatever guise it is taught, I see this, it creeps in. And people who learn mindfulness skills will not be able to stop these skills from occurring in all corners of their lives. It will creep into their relationship, it will creep into their constructs of meaning. And I see this is great. I'm sure I have my opinions about some of the trainings and about some of the ambitions and about some of the marketing that goes on and some of the pricing that goes on. Yeah. But I support the mindfulness movement. I'm training mindfulness teachers. I'm supervising mindfulness teachers. I'm meeting mindfulness teachers in clinical context for CPD programs. I think I'm thrilled. As a Buddhist meditator and ex-monk, I'm thrilled that this reaches now areas of society I would never have dreamt it would reach, and I would never be able to go or be invited, because I'm suspicious as a notorious Buddhist. And yet, the crazy thing is, I am going to some of these places because some of the people we have trained are having a say there, and they want. I meet a lot of genuine interest in Buddhist psychology amongst these people. You know, initially this starts off with a little bit of clinical mindfulness, and then they become interested in actually how to deepen that into their lives, and then they become interested into the conceptual frameworks from a contemplative tradition. And I see a lot of genuine interest. Now, if anything goes popular and leaves the context out of which it originally comes, it means with that popularization goes a degree of fuzziness. It goes, you know, you Google mindfulness and you find out there's something Americans do against depression, and John Kabat-Zinn has invented it. Yeah? And, you know, you get a three-line definition. It's basically a cognitive behavioral strategy against autobiographic rumination. It helps you keep your thinking in check. And it means it's deliberate and non-conceptual, and it's non-judgmental, and that's it. Yeah, you can do it without believing anything. Fair enough? Yeah. I do not think that this is what it is, but I do think this is a beginning. I do think this is useful. And who knows? People who find that useful are maybe willing to look a little deeper and find, okay, there's more to mindfulness than met the eye initially, and once they're willing. I don't feel this has to be only for card-carrying Buddhist members and people who are willing to carry the whole Pali canon around, and who are willing to shave their heads and go into a monastery. I'm very happy for this to go out there, and some people will run with it and find out more and deepen it and understand the depth and the breadth of it, and some people will derive the benefit to the extent they have chosen to engage with it, and I find this is perfectly legit. Yeah. My two cents on it. I try to help instill in the mindfulness world some notions, some of the more glaring reductionist interpretations of it, and I decided to just engage with this world and bring in there what I believe is a more wholesome or a more comprehensive or a more authentic understanding of mindfulness. And I find many people in this world to be highly motivated and refreshingly intelligent and inquisitive, and I enjoy the stimulation of this. Yeah, let us sit 5 minutes and then we end today. Thank you for your